Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Did you miss the most recent episode of TT Book? Your Alexa smart speaker can help you out. Say, "Alexa, play To the Best of Our Knowledge" to hear the latest show. WPR is here for you, on the radio, at WPR.org, on the app, and hands-free on Alexa.
Thanks so much for joining us today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk vehicle maintenance. And Jim Ward is back with us. He retired last year as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota in Madison and was with the company for 36 years. So we'll talk with him about getting your vehicle ready for cold and snow, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions. What do you want to know about winterizing your car? Are you having problems with your vehicle? Other kinds of questions. Love to hear from you. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Jim Ward, welcome back. You know, we haven't talked since last January.
Right. Huh? It's great to be back. Yeah, it's been an interesting year.
Yeah, what have you been up to since you retired? Are you still working with cars?
Not much. I certainly work on my own car, and we have done quite a bit of traveling this year. We did a road trip from the West Coast back and just saw a lot of the country. That was fantastic. We had more time for camping. I've dragged our trailer up north a few different times, and had a couple breakdowns. I had my alternator fail in the middle of a trip and picked one up and replaced it myself in a YMCA parking lot. So, yeah, I've got to work on vehicles a little bit.
Oh, well, you'd be a good guy to take it on a trip with. I can see that right now.
I got to keep too convinced of that, you know.
Well, having good tires, let's talk tires. It's important to safe winter driving. How do you know when it's time to get new ones?
Well, the tread depth measurement and the age of the tires is really the key. Typically, an ideal, you know, seasonal timing, your tires would be down to 3:30 seconds in the fall and time to replace them. The reality is a lot of people have a little bit more tread than that. 5:30 seconds in May, we would say, well, you could probably go a little while yet, though you might hydroplane on wet roads. But in October, that's time to replace them. There just isn't worth the risk on snow with that little bit of tread. And the other thing is that increasingly people are not driving their cars as much as they used to. And if you're not putting the mileage on, tires age and are affected by UV. So really when tires get about 5-6 years old, no matter what the tread depth, you should be thinking about replacing them because the sidewalls and rubber begin to break down. So tread depth and age are it for tires.
Should we get all four, or could we get by with maybe replacing the two back ones or something?
Well, usually tires wear pretty similarly. If they're rotated properly, they're going to have pretty even wear. And it's important to keep in mind as well that with four-wheel drive, all-wheel drive vehicles, the tread depth difference between the thickest tread depth and the thinnest shouldn't be more than 3/32 of an inch. Generally speaking, you're going to have tire recommendation replacements for all four of them. Again, it would be that isn't necessarily going to be the case absolutely every time, but it's more unusual than not when you're just going to replace a couple of tires because they're usually going to be near worn at the same time.
Yeah. And what tire is best suited to driving in Wisconsin?
Well, it depends on what you have to do. You know, if you live in town, if you live in the city of Madison and you have a commute that's not too awfully early in the morning, then, you know, Madison is pretty good at clearing the roads after a snowfall. And if your car is fairly new and your tires on a car typically start out at about 9/32 of an inch, maybe on a truck up to 11 or 12/32 of an inch. If you are on the upper half, you know, something over 6, preferably closer to 7 or 8, without snow tires, just all-season tires like most cars have on them, you will probably get through the winter okay. But if you live out in the country or if you have to commute particularly early before the roads are going to be cleared, you are a candidate that's going to want to think about, you know, a more dedicated, at least all-season tire. And snow tires are a completely different thing, and is that they're tested differently. They're tested for traction at temperature and under slippery conditions and tests that other tires are not. So a snow tire is going to be designated a little on the side that is like a little mountain with a snowflake in it, and that tire is tested in ways that no other types of tires are. So if you are in those circumstances, you live out in the country or you have to commute early before roads are cleared, you're a candidate for snow tires.
Yeah. You know, you're thinking about tires, there's a range of prices for tires. I mean, do you get what you pay for on tires?
Well, to a large degree, you do. I mean, you know, tires can run anywhere from $400 or $500 to well over $1,000, depending on the size of the tire and the vehicle that they're for. You know, you want to. Hopefully, most people have a shop that they work with, and they have some rapport with someone at that shop, and you want to talk to them about what it is they recommend and why. You know, it is typical that most places aren't just going to carry one range of tires. You know, typically you're going to have kind of a format of a good, better, best that, you know, there's a budget tire that isn't going to give you as long a life in terms of actual mileage that you'd ultimately get out of the tire. And then there are the best tires that have the best handling characteristics and give you good wear. So, you know, depending on your budget, you want to talk to the folks at the shop you work at. There certainly is a range, but like anything else, you get what you pay for. Has a great deal of truth to it.
Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota. Great to have him with us. Questions for him, give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. What's going on with your vehicle? Another thing we need for driving in winter is a functioning heater. I had a Volkswagen once that never seemed to function in terms of heat. But how do you maintain the heating system?
Well, the heating system of a vehicle has got a couple of different aspects. Inside the car, most modern cars have a cabin filter. And that cabin filter is what is supposed to collect pollen and dust and a lot of particulates in the air before they come into the cabin with you. That is something that the dirtier it is, the more it's going to restrict airflow and affect your defrost potentially. The heater in a car works from the heat from the antifreeze in the engine's cooling system. And so that engine's cooling system is something that has a regular scheduled maintenance. Antifreeze on different cars has an interval to be replaced, not nearly as frequent as it used to be. It used to be that we added tap water to antifreeze years ago, and that tap water had a lot of minerals in it that caused a breakdown of that antifreeze much quicker. Now most antifreeze is premixed. It uses more of a pure water that doesn't have the minerals in it and lasts longer, but still manufacturers are going to have intervals in the range of 4 or 5 years, 100,000 miles to replace that. So you should go by the manufacturer's recommendation and make sure the antifreeze gets replaced and that the system's checked, that there aren't any leaks in the system, because if you get low on antifreeze, you don't have to be low enough for the engine to overheat. You can be at probably half a quart to a quart low, and the first thing that's going to go is the heat for your heating system. It'll still cool the engine sufficiently, but you're really not going to have enough heat to keep you warm in the car, defrost windows properly. So those are things that really are key to your heater and defrosting system.
Well, you know, back to that cabin filter, when there's a, you know, you go in for a standard oil change and, you know, sort of a service check, does the service department usually check a cabin filter or not?
It is typically checked on one of those routine checks. It's very, very common. Both the engine's air filter and the cabin filter are typically checked on that inspection every time that you go in. And in most cases, they'll show it to you if there's a concern that it needs to be replaced. Well, it's assuming that you're there. More and more, even if you're not there, you know, it's not uncommon at all that they'll take a picture of it and text it to you. Just so you can see what it looks like. But, yep, it's a common inspection item. And, you know, the need for its replacement varies. There's a mileage schedule for it. But if you live out in the country and got to drive on a lot of dusty roads and dusty conditions, yours is going to get dirtier quicker than someone who doesn't have to drive under those circumstances.
Ellen in Cedarburg called. She's looking for a used stick shift car, and she's having problems finding one. Any suggestions?
Man, I'll tell you that it is more and more uncommon that people drive a stick and that people are looking for them. You know, all manufacturers still make a stick. In fact, my son bought a car late this last year and basically had never had an automatic transmission, was determined he wasn't going to get one, and after driving a couple, he broke down and bought an automatic. But, you know, most manufacturers, Toyota still makes a few vehicles with a stick, Volkswagen does, there are different companies out there, but they're more and more rare. So, you know, and if you've if you have driven a stick all your life, you've got a pretty good feel for what a clutch should feel like. You want to, if you're going to buy a used car that's got a stick, you want to make sure that the clutch is in good shape. So driving it and making sure there's some tests you can do to make sure, or have someone that is more familiar with how to test a clutch and make sure it's not about worn out or slipping. You know, a clutch can last a couple hundred thousand miles, but it can also be taken out pretty quickly by someone learning to drive that never drove a stick. You want to make sure that you're not going to buy a car like that used and find out you got to put a clutch replacement in it within 6 months.
So what about batteries? How do you know when it's time to get a new one?
Well, like that air filter inspection that's done on every check, the battery typically is checked on every one of those inspections too. And that's typically, you're going to take your vehicle, and it's recommended to take it in twice a year. And those tests don't just, you know, they'll test the potential of the battery going forward. So often a battery can be diagnosed well before the car fails to start and you're not stuck in an inconvenient situation. So that testing will tell you, you know, battery life has gotten longer and longer. It is, we have, actually, it's counterintuitive, but in Wisconsin, we have some of the better battery life that you'll see across the country. Heat is harder on batteries than cold. So in Arizona, average battery life is about 3 years, 3 to 4 years. In our part of the country, it's closer to 5 or 6 years. But those tests will tell. And basically, you know, your use of the car is also something that's going to determine battery life. More and more people are commuting less and less, working from home. Those cars aren't being driven. Those batteries aren't going to last as long as a battery that gets charged on a more regular basis. If you are in a situation where you don't commute as much and your car sits a lot, and if you have access to power at your car or garage that you have it in, you may want to consider getting a smart battery charger, a battery tender, common in the marine world where vehicles sit a lot, but that would help better maintain your battery than if you're just not driving it all the time.
How about if your car doesn't start and it's, how do we know it's a battery and not something else?
Well, there are different tests you can do. You can turn your lights on and have someone watch while you turn the key. If the lights go dim when you're trying to start it, or if they go out, that's a pretty good sign that the battery is too weak. If it's not the battery, the lights are likely not to be affected when you're trying to start it. There may be something else in the ignition system or wiring or something that's causing it. But that's, you know, that's one of the most obvious and easy ways to just, you know, to take a look and see if it's low battery voltage.
And how does it work with hybrid cars?
Well, a hybrid car, the battery does still start the car in a sense, but typically that 12-volt battery in a hybrid car is not powering a starter and turning the motor over. It's powering computers and allowing the computers to communicate. And then typically the larger battery, the hybrid battery, is what turns the electric motor that's attached to the gas engine and starts. It allows it to start. So it's a little bit different setup, but you still have to have that 12-volt battery. If the computers can't, come on board, then it's not going to start. And so you're going to have a real similar symptoms of warning lights in an engine or a vehicle that's just not readying on or not starting.
Jim Ward, our guest today, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota. Great to have him with us. If you have a question about your vehicle, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Aubrey Ralph, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today as we talk your automobile. Vehicle maintenance on our mind with Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota. Was with Toyota for 36 years, and he knows a lot about cars. Questions for him, give a call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Randy and Ripon, we'll go to you now. Randy, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, just talking about electric and electric vehicles, it made me think of my younger days in a Beetle and trying while freezing to death in one. And one thing that I always bring up with a full electric is, how do you heat it? and how does that affect the mileage on them? I wonder if your guests want to address that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Randy.
Sure, sure. And, boy, I'll tell you, that brings back memories of Volkswagens. I had several air-cooled Volkswagens, and I remember scraping the windshield on the inside on the way to work some days. But electric vehicles, those hybrid vehicles are a hybrid of gas engine and electric, and they still have a gas engine, which is the primary heat source. But those vehicles also have heat elements that are in, often they'll have a heat element at the base of the windshield. They'll have heater elements in the ducting for the defrost to help facilitate that gas engine heating. And you know, all electric vehicles simply have electric heating systems that use electricity to do it. There is a cost for that from the vehicle, just like there's a cost to a regular conventional gas engine to with the blower to produce the electricity that's going to tax on the alternator, which is horsepower from that engine, is going to cause some gas power. The same way with an electric vehicle, part of that electric potential is going to be used to produce that heat that you have. And even a hybrid that uses both the gas and the electric, yep, there's always a cost for any kind of comfort that we that we have on the inside of the car.
Randy, thank you very much for calling. Ellen in Neshota, your turn. Hi, Ellen.
Thank you. Actually, it's Neosho, but yes. Good morning, Larry and guest. I have a 2012 Toyota Tacoma, which uses synthetic oil. The operator's manual recommends an oil change every 5,000 miles, but I've heard that synthetic oils can go a lot longer between oil changes. Can your guest please advise just when that oil should be changed?
Well, in that particular vehicle, Toyota uses that same synthetic oil in a number of different engines. And in many of those engines, actually the majority of them, it's a 10,000-mile interval that they recommend. The Tacoma, because of that engine, its configuration, and what they anticipate people are going to usually do with the truck and work a little bit harder, that engine will be under a bit more load, they recommend that 5,000-mile interval. And over the years, I have kind of changed my opinion a little bit about this. Is under ideal circumstances, 5,000 or 10,000 mile interval for most of those engines that have that recommendation would be fine. The fact of the matter is, what we've learned is over the years, as they get more miles on them, some of those engines are prone to start to consume some oil. It wouldn't be unusual at all for an engine to consume a quart of oil in 10,000 miles. And, you know, unfortunately, much of the motoring public has gotten out of the habit of checking oil, adding oil in between oil change intervals. And so, you know, it's not, I generally still recommend staying with manufacturer recommendations on most maintenance items, but if you have a higher mileage vehicle, even if the interval was 10,000 miles, I would strongly consider changing it more to 5,000-mile interval. I've kind of gone to that on my own vehicles because, again, if they're using oil and you're not keeping ahead of it, you know, on the other hand, if you're a person who knows how to check the oil and is consistent at doing it and, you know, willing to go buy the oil and add it in between, it's perfectly fine to go the longer interval. But on your Tacoma, it is the manufacturer's recommendation is 5,000 miles.
Yeah, so you better stick to that, Ellen. And let's take another call. Diane in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Oh, I really like your show. I've always been a car person, and I just enjoy all the great information. And I chuckled when I heard you talk about the Beetle. That was my first car in 1970.
Yeah.
And his name was Harold, and he was so cute. But that was a long time ago. My question is, how can you tell when it's time to change the battery and the key fob?
Well, it can be tested. A lot of modern cars will have a warning. Our own little Prius actually has a warning that pops up on the dash that tells you that it's getting low because of a little computer, a little receiver that gets a signal, has a computer that will read how strong the signal is. But most parts departments, most parts stores have a little device that they can turn on, and you press the button, and as you hold it further away, that you can measure the signal strength. So at 3 feet, it should be a certain amount of signal strength, and if it's lower than that, then that battery is getting weak, and it's time to replace it.
Ah, there you go. Thank you, Diane. Appreciate the call. Jay in Two Rivers, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jay.
Thank you. I've got two vehicles that I swap out. I have one in storage. It does not have power, so I can't use a battery tender, but I exchange them monthly, and then drive each one extensively so that the batteries are thoroughly kept up, topped up. But I'm wondering how often it's recommended to recharge a car battery to prevent sulfation.
Well, that depends a little bit on the use of that battery and how quickly it discharges. You know, if your car's sitting, there's still some draw on the battery, and you know, essentially, you want to measure what voltage it's got available. You don't really want it to get down below about 11.8 volts. You know, one of the things too that you know, in that situation, it sounds like you were swapping them out enough to keep the batteries maintained, but you can always pull the battery out of the vehicle and take it to somewhere where you do have power and put a smart tender on it. So the vehicle, to maintain the battery, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the vehicle. So that's another option there. But, yep, the thing about lead-acid batteries is that they don't do well if you discharge them below 50%. So, you know, you can charge it down to about 50% and charge it back up many, many, many times. But if that charge gets below 50%, then you're going to start having those kind of chemical issues with sulfation and earlier failure of the battery.
Hmm. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it. Another battery question. Carl called. He has a 2020 RAV4 hybrid, and his battery died after the car sat for 8 days while he was on vacation. The dealer said this will happen because the computer will drain the battery even if it isn't in use. And it kind of goes along with what you were just saying, but he was wondering if this is true, and if so, why? 8 days seems kind of short.
It does, but a hybrid has much more demand on that battery. You know, and part of it may be the condition the battery was in before it was left for the 8 days. You know, if you are someone who's driving your car and commuting and driving it every single day, I would expect you might get closer to 2 weeks before that battery failed. You know, but if you weren't really using it a lot and the battery wasn't in a great state of charge before you parked it for 8 days, then that's part of your answers. You know, batteries sometimes will fail earlier, although by battery, when we say the battery died, and he says that, we're not talking about, in all likelihood, I guess I don't know the circumstance, but we're probably not talking about a battery that failed and had to be replaced, a battery that discharged and just didn't have enough charge to start the vehicle. One of the things that I really recommend that you have in a car all times of year, but especially in the winter, is some kind of jump-starting system. Jumper cables are what we always used to recommend and talk about, and most people are familiar with jumper cables, maybe hesitant to use them, but now they have devices that are a small battery, and some of these aren't much bigger than maybe, you know, twice the size of your cell phone, that can be used to charge a cell phone, but they can also be used to jumpstart a car. And so having a device like that in your car, and particularly with hybrids that don't have as long a period of time that they can just sit in an airport or sit where you're going on vacation, it's just a good idea. If you have that there, you get back, you find the battery's discharged, you're not nearly as inconvenienced when you can just hook this thing up quick and go. So, you know, it is certainly not unusual that 8 to 10 days you may find a hybrid battery system discharged from sitting that long.
Take another call. Bill in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Bill.
I had, back in 87, we bought a new Topaz, and it had all-wheel drive, which in order to engage the rear, you'd have to flip a rocker switch. And a couple of occasions I had where I had my foot on the brake and nowhere near the gas, like one of the times pulling into my driveway, and all of a sudden it surged and the thing wanted to jump forward like I had stomped on the gas. And it's like, well, when we traded off that car, I was glad to get rid of it because I was afraid that someone would end up getting run over.
Hmm.
What do you think might cause that?
Well, there are different things that can cause that surge. Were there specific circumstances under which it occurred? Would it occur? I mean, a surge can be caused by one set of circumstances. When the car is cold or warming up, it might be a completely different set of circumstances and causes once the car is completely warmed up. When the car is warming up, when you first start a car, the idle may be very high. If the battery is discharged a little bit, it's trying to run the engine faster, to turn the alternator faster, to charge the battery faster. There are devices that will cause the engine's idle speed and base engine speed to speed up, like running the air conditioner. Your air conditioner, when you have it on, is more like your furnace at home. It doesn't run constantly, so when it turns on and off, you sometimes can feel it. When it turns on, there's a device that's supposed to kick the idle up of the engine. Again, in ideal circumstances, when those things are working perfectly, you wouldn't really even feel it, but that's often not the case. There are often times that when the air conditioner cycles on, there's an idle up, it's called the solenoid or device, and if that comes on right at that moment as you're coming to a stop, you can feel that surge, and it may make it feel like the car is going to lurch, or actually make the car lurch ahead. There are also devices that help control air mixture, idle air screw valves, and different things like that that can get varnished up and gummy and stick and cause those kind of symptoms. So there certainly are a handful of different kind of things that can cause that, and it is certainly disconcerting. I mean, don't blame you for getting into the car. I mean, it's something you could pursue trying to get diagnosed and fixed, but, oh, man, that's a scary thought when you think you're about to come to a stop and she wants to lurch ahead a couple more feet.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Aubrey, our engineer, drives a Prius, and the mileage goes way down in the winter. He gets like 57 in the summer and 30 in the winter. What causes that big difference?
Well, all vehicles are going to lose some fuel efficiency in the winter. Vehicles are simply less efficient in the winter. One of the easiest ways I could describe that to you is show up some really cold day at your car dealership and offer to help push in a car that didn't start, that they have to push in the shop. You find out really quick that doing that in July and doing that in January are very different experiences. The amount of rolling resistance that just the pure mechanicals, you know, bearings and tires and everything else have in that really cold weather is very, very noticeable. On top of that, electrical systems are very much affected by cold weather. There's just a loss of efficiency right off the top. So it's not unusual for conventional gas engine vehicles to lose about a third of their gas mileage in the wintertime. This is greatly dependent on the kind of driving you have to do. The shorter your drive, the less of your driving time that you're going to be driven with a fully warmed up engine. So if you're commuting 3 to 5 miles, most of your commute is going to be with an engine that's not warm and not nearly at the efficiency that it would be once it's warmed up. If you have a longer commute, you might not lose quite that percentage of fuel mileage that others do, but it's the combination of just the lesser efficiency of both fuel burning systems, electrical drive systems, and the mechanical systems that roll the car from the tires to the wheel bearings to the axles.
Let's go to Tom in Buffalo County now. Tom, hello.
Yes, hello. Yeah, I have a tire that's making this thumping noise. I was able to diagnose because I rotated the tires from rear to front, and suddenly I get this noise on the front, the thump, 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 which is in sync with the speed of the car. So it's a bad belt. It should be under warranty. How difficult is it to get a tire replaced under warranty? I got this tire from a small independent shop, just a one-man operation. So how do you prove the mileage and so that you put on the tire and so on?
Well, hopefully you've got documentation. You bought it from him. He would have made a repair order for that work. At, you know, state of Wisconsin, a legal repair order is going to have all of your vehicle's identification information on it, the VIN number and such, and the mileage on it. So I wouldn't say that happens in every shop every time a repair is done, but it should happen, and that's why it should happen, is that documentation's important for the application of a warranty. Tire warranties can be kind of a frustrating thing for a shop and an owner, you know. But someone else might be in a circumstance where they bought this tire and the shop's not even in business anymore. So the tire, whatever the manufacturer of the tire is, Goodyear, you know, BF Goodrich, whatever, you can actually contact the manufacturer and hopefully you have that repair order and have that documentation. If you don't, hopefully the shop still got copies of that and has that information. You know, a lot of times the manufacturer will not make a call on whether they're going to say they're going to warranty that tire or not until the tire's been taken off the rim and they look at the inside to see if there's any indication of damage, because belt separation can be caused by hitting a big pothole. Most of the time when you buy tires, with those tires you'll be offered or automatically get with them a road hazard warranty. That is to say that if you were to pick up a nail or hit a pothole and cause damage to the tire, that it would be covered. So in those circumstances, hopefully have that kind of coverage. It usually lasts for at least the first couple of years of the tire's life. So that's something else. And something else to keep in mind, you may be absolutely right that it's a separated belt. That would be a common cause of that symptom. But a big rock or a tar patch that gets picked up in the tread of a tire can cause that same symptom. You don't have to repair or replace a tire. You could take that. It's not a easiest job, but heat up that tar patch and take a tool like a screwdriver and get it off the tire. So there is a possibility that it's not a bad tire. I've seen that caused by other circumstances like that as well.
All right. There you go, Tom. Thank you. Jim in Rhinelander. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. I have like a 1966 Plymouth Valiant with 475,000 miles on it, and I've got an Optima battery in it. It's a great car. It runs good, and I'd like to find some kind of a website, if you're aware of it, where you can find older vehicles that people take care of because they don't make the Plymouth Valiant anymore. But what's weird is that, I mean, believe it or not, it's got a little rust on it, and I've been leaving in the parking lot with the keys in, and I can't get anyone to steal it, you know, because it's a little rusty. So I'd like to find another Plymouth Valiant, and I'm wondering if you have some suggestions where I'd find, you know, some vehicles that which I just think is a very reliable vehicle that always works, you know.
Sure. Well, I belong to a couple of different Facebook groups that are older and it's literally called Older and Unappreciated Vehicles. You know, and some of those have year ranges that they are talking about, and others are just more wide open to those. But, you know, there are also Plymouth Facebook groups for those kind of things. So, you know, if you are on Facebook and you do a search there, but even if you're not on Facebook, you could do a Google search. I don't know of a specific group that I can tell you off the top of my head, but they are certainly out there. You know, and keeping a 66 Valiant at 475,000 miles, you are definitely not going to be alone there. There's going to be others out there that are definitely enthusiasts.
There you go, Jim. Get online, take a look. Deborah in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I have a 2011 Toyota Corolla, and my horn does not work, and my rear window defogger, the top portion of it works, and the lower portion doesn't work so well. And I'm wondering, when I take it to the garage, what questions do I ask to make sure that they're going to be doing the right repairs instead of just bungling along until they find out what's wrong?
Well, I'm really just giving them the symptoms. These are a couple of things that are not extremely difficult diagnosis. Neither one of these are intermittent conditions, so it's not like it. One of the more difficult things to diagnose, and where are these going down this path and then that path and then another path, those often occur when the problem is intermittent, because you can only get so far. Intermittent meaning that it acts up sometimes and then it starts working. So as you can imagine, you're a technician, you're looking at a vehicle, something isn't working, you're working away at the diagnosis, and you're an hour in and it begins to work. You're stuck in the water at that point. You can't really make any more progress. But with a horn that doesn't work and doesn't work at all, in most cases, it's going to be the horn itself. But, you know, what they're going to do first is check and see if there's power at the horn. That's a pretty quick, easy process. You take your voltmeter out there. When someone's pushing on the horn button, is there power? If there is, you've got a bad horn. The defrost, too, is going to lend itself to a pretty easy diagnosis, because the fact that you already have the upper half of the windshield clearing tells us there is power there. That symptom, the majority of time, 99.9% of the time, is going to be an actual scratch or damage to one of the lines, and it's probably going to be the line that is the first one that doesn't work coming down that back glass. They do make kits to, it's almost like a electrical conductive paint that once you find that spot, and sometimes you can find it really by just looking visually, you'll see a little scratch, something might have got set on that rear deck window, and it doesn't take much. I mean, it's just a Kleenex box being slid back there, a sharp corner of cardboard Kleenex box can scratch a line on that and cause it to open the circuit. But, you know, hopefully it is an open that is able to be fixed. Not every shop does that kind of repair. You may end up being told you need a rear glass replacement with the whole electrical grid in it. But there are kits, and it can be fixed. And, I mean, it is something, you know, in my experience over the years, you know, a lot of those kits, we would only have success about 50% of the time. But they've improved them. They've improved the material so it sticks on better. But that's what's going to be going on with that rear defroster. And the horn, it could be something else in the horn circuit. It could be the horn button. But when a horn doesn't work, in my experience over the years, you know, the vast majority of the time, it was the horn itself. They're out there in the weather. They're exposed. It's not an uncommon failure.
There you go, Deborah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Tony in Mount Horeb, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Tony.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. It's a 2010 Corolla with 100,000 miles on. Seems the suggested maintenance doesn't call for any fluid changes other than coolant at 100,000. Otherwise, it's just inspect and adjust all fluid levels. I was wondering about brake, differential, power steering fluid changes.
Yep, those are things that Toyota doesn't have an interval. Different manufacturers will pick certain fluids that they'll set an interval for. You know, other manufacturers will just simply recommend that there be an inspection. You know, like brake fluid, they'll look at it. There are devices that there's a little refractometer that you can put a drop of brake fluid on and take a look. And basically, what you're determining for is how much rust is in it. Brake fluid, for example, is a hygroscopic fluid. That means it kind of absorbs moisture to keep a water bubble from forming somewhere in it and causing a interference in the braking action. And that, over time, will cause that brake fluid to break down. Some manufacturer would have a two-year interval on brake fluid replacement. Toyota does not. So they just expect the technician to take a look at it, evaluate it, and let you know when they think that fluid needs attention. So transmission and differential fluids are something that Toyota will have intervals for, depending on how you drive. At about a 60,000-mile interval is when they're going to recommend those things. But, yeah, you're right. At 100,000 miles, the antifreeze is the only thing they recommend. And then after that, it's really only every 50,000 miles. It's a little bit increased after that first change. But, yep, those things can be inspected and evaluated to determine if they really need any attention or not.
There you go, Tony. Thank you for calling. Ron in Portage, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I have, for the last 10 years, I live on the country. My vehicles are outside. I have had damage from rodents. I have, in the last year, I put a trail camera out. I know there are red squirrels climbing up into the engine, gray squirrels. I've had woodchucks. So those are ones I know for sure. Yeah. I've been told that there's a soy-based product in the sheathing of the wiring. So I'm wondering what sort of remedies there are for this.
Well, there are many different things people have tried over the years, and those various rodents will likely get used to a certain type of deterrent over time and not be as bothered by it. And so people have used naphtha flakes, which is the same material that that you put in laundry and drawers to try to keep the critters, the rodents out of that, dryer sheets or something else. But the thing that I have found and the thing that the industry has found that they don't ever get used to and is related to capsaicin from pepper. So there's actually a tape that is made from capsaicin. It's a tape like you'd wrap around your wire harnesses. I don't know if it's soy. Manufacturers don't necessarily come out and tell us the compounds that their wire harnesses are insulated in, but I can vouch for the fact that over the years they have become much more palatable to rodents like that to want to chew on those and eat that stuff up. And not just the wiring sometimes, it's the plastics themselves. I've seen where a rodent chewed right through the plastic housing of a fuse box in a truck just because the plastic seemed to taste good to it. So basically, tape that has capsaicin in it sprays. The tape is kind of permanent. Once you put the tape on wiring, that's going to work as long as the tape is there. You know, I have the same issues with squirrels coming after bird feeders, and I warred with the squirrels for years until I finally started putting cayenne pepper in with the bird seed. The birds don't mind it at all, and the squirrel's going to be one and done. He's not coming back for that stuff a second time. So between sprays and different types of capsaicin applications, that is really going to be your most permanent because, again, things like dryer sheets and naphtha flakes, it seems like the rodents, they might be deterred the first or second time, but eventually they kind of get used to that smell and get more comfortable just coming in and looking for something to eat anyway.
There you go, Tony. Thank you so much for calling. Jim Ward, our guest, retired last year as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking vehicle maintenance today with Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. Great to have him back. And lots of callers online, so I think we'll just go back to the phones and to Barbara in Milwaukee. Hi, Barbara.
Good day. I'd like to know what I'm not afraid of an older, low-mileage vehicle in buying a used car. but what about a 2008 Prius with 170,000 miles on it? Is that high mileage? What's the extended life expectancy of that vehicle?
Well, with any used vehicle, some, whether it's a hybrid or Prius or anything else, you want to get some of its previous history. So you want to look at a Carfax, find out if there's an accident history, find out if it was maintained. Did they take it in and do regular maintenance on it? Beyond that, you know, a Prius at that mileage, you know, really is something that is typically just broken in. Although I do have to say that particular engine, there were a couple of years there, 7 and 8, where those vehicles were one of them that we talked about earlier. Some vehicles will start to develop some oil consumption. So that would be one concern that I might have there. There was a countermeasure Toyota came out with, but they didn't do a recall where they had different pistons and rings for 07s and 08s to try to resolve that oil consumption. So if you looked at a Carfax, you could see if it possibly had that work done. And you know, that would be preferable. You know, if it's something that if you're buying it from a dealer, they're probably not going to necessarily know that history and know whether it was something that was using oil or not. But you know, if you're buying it from a private owner and it's a one owner, you could ask them that question. You know, hopefully they'd be honest and tell you that. But you know, Priuses are very, very good vehicles, but generally there's a couple year models there I'd be a little wary of, and I'd be looking for that specific information.
There you go, Barbara. Thank you. Well, on to on to Dave in Toma. Dave, hello.
2012 Honda Odyssey. And the problem I've had ever since I got it is, like, you're coming up to make a turn, you let off the gas, and you push on the gas again. There is no power, nothing at all.
So the Odyssey, you're breaking up there, Dave, but the Odyssey, when you let up, when you brake and set the power again, there's nothing there?
Right, and yeah, you hit it a couple of times and the power comes back again.
Well, that is a symptom I've heard of, and I have seen that is often a transmission concern. Different manufacturers have had that situation. The modern transmissions have this incredible ability to be in a pretty high gear at low speeds to give you some of the great mileage and fuel economies they have, but sometimes the transmissions have a problem of being a bit indecisive about what is going to happen next when you've slowed down and go to accelerate again. And many manufacturers, I'm not sure Honda had one for this, but most manufacturers would have a fix for that, which is often just a software download to tell that transmission computer to do this a bit differently and make it a little bit more sensitive to that acceleration after you've let off. Now, there could be different things in the fuel system causing it, but my experience, usually that's a transmission concern, and usually a reprogram or a reflash, they'll call it, would resolve that.
There you go, Dave. Check it out with your Honda dealer. On to Phil now in Kingston. Hi.
Hello, thanks for taking the call. I have a 2002 Buick LeSabre, has about 165,000 on it. The only thing is, I noticed whenever I had it, I bought it 2 years ago, you'd hear this slight or feel a slight kind of like bumping or something when you're driving city speed, 30, 35. But once you get like 65, 70, it starts to shake almost violently. It's like shaking all over the place, knocking my stuff off the dashboard. When I reach anything over 60, it just shakes like crazy. But on slower speeds, you just feel like a thump, 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 thump. What could that be?
Well, those are classic descriptions of a tire issue. You know, that typically a tire that's out of balance is going to give you a vibration or shaking at specific speed ranges, depending on what the problem is. It might be at 45, it might be at 65, but it, you know, somewhere in the range of a 5 to 10 mile an hour range of speed, you feel a shake. If it's shaking the steering wheel pretty hard, you know, it's probably a front tire. If it's just kind of feels like almost like the whole car is shaking, it's probably coming from the back. And, you know, the thumping could be the same cause. It could be a tire that's just got a bit of a belt separation causing a tire to also be out of balance. But, you know, that typically is it. It is what's going to cause it. One of the easiest ways before you just go replace tires, I would try rotating them front to rear and see if it changes the characteristic. You can usually tell by the tire rotation, as a previous caller had mentioned too, it'll change the characteristic of the vibration. If it's a front tire and you rotate front to rear and put it on the rear, it's still going to be there, but you're not going to feel it the same. You're going to be able to tell that it was moved to a different position. So that's how I would go about determining, A, if it is tires. I mean, it's possible something in the driveline could be causing this, but the vast majority of the time, that kind of a symptom is going to be a tire issue.
There you go, Phil. Thank you. Charlie in Chippewa Falls. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
Yeah, I got a 1990 Toyota 3.0 six-cylinder that fairly low mileage, 70,000-ish. Seems to be running hot. Replaced the radiator, thermostat, water pump, timing belt, all the sensors. Seems to me that it's running hot. First of all, I don't really know what the actual operating temperature should be, but what would cause that?
Man, it sounds like, you know, now what model is the vehicle with that engine in it?
Well, it's in a motorhome, so it's a one-ton chassis.
Yeah, yeah, and a 1990, and I do recall seeing some issues with those, you know, and I have people go through all the things that you're describing. You said you did replace the radiator?
Yeah, new three-core radiator, thermostat, fluids, everything.
Yep, yep, and, you know, it, what you're probably going to have to do is put in a modified thermostat to open earlier. You know, in the motorhome, that engine did fine in the Toyota trucks that it was really set up in, but in the motorhome, it's kind of pushing the load of that engine a bit, and I do recall about 1990 seeing a couple of those come in that had an overheating where they'd gone through everything that you had in the cooling system. You know, and I think, as I recall, the only way we really was able to resolve it was by putting a thermostat that made the engine run a little bit cooler. Unfortunately, that kind of nicked away at fuel mileage a little bit too, but it's better than having an engine overheat. But it sure sounds like you've gone through all the typical, you know, culprits that you could replace, but I do recall that being an issue in the motorhomes, that engine was just a little underpowered for the load that it was pushing.
All right. There you go, Charlie. Thank you. Marsha in Richmond, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I have an 05 Chevy Malibu. Love it. Wonderful car. But I have so much road noise in my car, and I'm constantly told that the tires are Goodyear Assurance is the label on the tire. They're relatively new tires, like 2 years old perhaps, and they've rotated and everything, and I'm told that it's because of variances in the road itself, nothing to do with my tires, but impossible to even have a conversation in the car. So I'm wondering if it could be something else going on there.
Well, it could be something in the driveline. There are, you know, a wheel bearing can make a noise that's very much like a tire. And, you know, the wheel bearing is something that, you know, going down the road, you can't always distinguish and differentiate between what might be a wheel bearing noise and a tire noise. But a mechanic who's experienced with this can put it up on a lift. I mean, typically, you know, when we put a vehicle over, when we're checking for wheel bearings, we'll actually manually spin that wheel, feel the suspension, and if, you know, like on a front suspension, the coil spring will actually have a vibration in it from the wheel bearing that you wouldn't have, for example, perhaps on the other side of if it didn't have a bad bearing. It's not likely to have bad bearings on both sides. So a wheel bearing could give you that symptom if the tires really look, you know, fine and aren't making any noise. The easiest thing to do, though, in terms of eliminating tires is that, you know, if what we would typically do would be take a used car that had the same tires and same wheels and swap them out and take the car for a drive with the different tires and wheels on it. Obviously, if it was a tire, you're going to have eliminated it, and it's going to be quiet now. If it was a wheel bearing, it's not going to have made any difference to put those different tires on it. But, you know, you don't want to have to go out and buy new tires just to do that experiment and find that out. But, you know, I would take it to a shop and ask them if they could evaluate wheel bearings. Wheel bearings also, when they're wearing out and making noise like that, develop a kind of a free play where, again, if the car's up on a lift, an experienced technician can feel that it almost feels like lug nuts are a little loose or something. There's just more back and forth play on a tire as you grab it and move it, try to move it from side to side. So there are certainly some things a technician could do to evaluate if there's a wheel bearing starting to make that sound. You know, like I said, it sounds like you've already pursued having someone look at and inspect the tires, and they're telling you those are okay. So that would be the next most likely thing.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. JJ on Washington Island emailed. He has a 2010 Prius with 140,000 miles. Wants to know when the hybrid battery needs to be replaced, and how much are those batteries?
Well, the hybrid battery, you know, like an engine or transmission in a conventional vehicle, is something that, you know, used to be 100,000 miles was uncommon on a conventional car for an engine or transmission. Now it's you know, just expected that they're all going to go at least 100,000 miles and probably closer to 200,000 or 300,000 miles. Most of the previous batteries, you know, that I've had experience with have lasted much longer than that, probably close to twice that time. That being said, sometimes they will fail earlier at that point. Replacements have gotten more and more competitive. Manufacturers that make the cars often were not recommending the best warranties on them a few years ago, and then the aftermarket started springing up with remanufactured and refurbished batteries and offering three-year warranties. So now, you know, like Toyota and most other car manufacturers that offer that offer that hybrid battery, offer a longer warranty, like a three-year warranty with it. They're not cheap to replace. I mean, they are fairly expensive, and you know, you're probably talking at least a couple thousand dollars to do that job. You know, it is not common to have it fail that early. You know, in most cases, I would expect that to be about half of its life.
Even at $2,000, it's cheaper than buying another one.
Absolutely, yep.
There you go. Thanks so much for that question. Jim Ward, our guest today, retired last year as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, with the company 36 years, and he knows an awful lot about cars. It's great to have him with us, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at vehicle maintenance on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors of Toyota. Great to have him back, and certainly I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Our lines are all filled at the moment. Let's take a call from Karen in Watertown. Hi, Karen.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize this was maintenance and probably for Toyota, which is what I'm driving. Can I ask a question about a Dodge Ram?
Sure.
Okay. We bought it as a tradesman. It was, we had the cage and everything out or in it, and we took it out and turned it into a travel van. But every time we open the doors and then close the doors, within a half an hour, and the motor is turned off, within a half an hour, so not always right away, it will click 18 times. We don't know why, and we've taken it to several places, several mechanics, and they can't figure it out either.
And Karen, what does it do after that time period? It did you say it makes a clicking sound?
Yes, I can count them. Click, 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 18 times.
18 times.
And then it's done. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, there are different devices that use the door closing, and that will do different things. For example, a lot of vehicles will have headlights that are programmed to turn off like 30 seconds after the door is closed. And in many cases, that's programmable. You can set it for 30 seconds, a minute and a half. You know, I don't know what it is on that vehicle, but there's something that obviously there's a malfunction that is trying to signal that it's been this long since the door closed, but a relay or something sticking and trying to engage and isn't able to. You said you've taken into shops and they've experienced it. They've been able to hear it, but can't get to the bottom of it. Is that right?
We can hear it, but we have no idea. Nobody can figure out exactly where it's coming from. And I want to add that it's 2016, so there's no app. It's not new enough.
Well, you know, if I was going to go about this myself, it would be in a pretty rudimentary way. The sound obviously is coming from somewhere. One of the problems with vehicles is identifying where sounds are coming from. There are little devices that are, it's like a wand. You put earphones on and it's directional. So when you point it, you will hear a much amplified audio signal from that specific direction. And so ultimately, if I was going to try to diagnose this, I would get in there with one of those. I would get it to duplicate it. It sounds like it's easily duplicatable. It sounds like it does this every time and isn't intermittent. And ultimately, using that wand, I'm going to get to the point, to the relay or whatever that is clicking. Now, unfortunately, just because you find the relay is clicking doesn't necessarily mean you found the problem. But that is at least a start. Once I know what relay or what device it is that's making the sound, then I can start to troubleshoot a little bit more specifically on that circuit. I would have to then look at schematics, find out what that relay is supposed to do and when it's supposed to do it to try to get to the bottom of whether it's the malfunction or something else. It basically has to start doing testing to find out if it's getting the right voltage signals at the right times. But first you have to know where it is. So, you know, that sounds like kind of a tough one, but that's how I would go about trying to get to the bottom of that.
There you go, Karen. Thank you. Good luck. Kathy in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. So I drive a 2014 Jetta, VW Jetta manual diesel. And I've driven a manual VW Jetta diesel. This is my second one. The first one was 2003. And over the years, I've had so many mechanics say to me something along the lines of, oh, this is a great engine, a diesel. It'll run forever. You'll get 300,000 miles out of it. And I just wonder, I've never followed up on the why of that. Is it just because a diesel engine is simpler, or why is it that I am consistently told that?
Well, a diesel engine is simpler in some regards. It, you know, you don't have the same type of ignition system that a gas engine has, but more specifically, diesel engines, because of the type of combustion it does have, they have to be built a bit heavy duty. They're heavier metal. It's just, you know, it is a more robust construction of an engine. Typically, when it's a diesel. Now, that being said, there are certainly different diesel engines out there that have issues. But Volkswagen's had you know, good luck with theirs. And ultimately, you know, if the maintenance is done on that engine, it is just simply true that they don't tend to suffer some of the common wear and tear that conventional gas engines do.
Interesting. Thanks for that call. David and Taylor, we'll go to you. Hi, David. Oh, we're not hearing David. He has a 4Runner with squealing brakes. When he steps on the brakes, why do the brakes squeal?
Well, it would be interesting to know the year. I know that there, and these are some fairly late model 4Runners before I retired, that I was still waiting for some answers from Toyota. We hadn't gotten an answer yet, but like 2017, 18, there were some 4Runner models out there that had terrible brake squeal. Over the years, I've seen different manufacturers, Toyota primarily, although I was with Volkswagen for 5 years, and I worked at a dealer that was, we were Volkswagen, Porsche, Audi, Mercedes, Mazda, Fiat, DeLorean. Everybody has issues with brake squeal from time to time, but specifically in the cases of the 4Runner, it had not been resolved yet before I retired. Other cases I've seen over the years, though, I've seen, you know, manufacturers focus on brake pads. Often the makeup of the actual compound of the brake pad can be a cause. I remember one instance of it where we waited about 14 months from the time the vehicles were manufactured until they really got to the bottom of it. And it was a brake rotor issue. It was a vented rotor, and it was something about the venting veins between the inner side and outside of the rotor that caused a vibration to build up that would cause a noise that essentially they had to design a different brake rotor to resolve it. And in most cases, it's a matter of the compound of the brake pad and different brake pads. Now, that all being said, most brake squeak that shops look at tends to be what they call normal. But by normal is that if the brakes are if your car sits out a lot, if it's not driven as frequently, if you are a softer braker, brake moderately, which is typically what we recommend you do, brake early and brake a little softer, that can allow some oxidation to build up both on the brake rotor and on the brake pad itself, but mostly on the rotor. That flash oxidation they cause it can cause brake squeal. If that's the cause of it, usually if you take your car out, you know, when you first start driving it, If you can get up near highway speed and brake hard a couple of times, obviously be very careful if you do something like that. I'm not talking about braking hard enough to lock up wheels, and you certainly want to be aware of what's around you, and particularly behind you in traffic, you know, before you do something like that. But typically that kind of braking action will quickly grind that flash oxidation off and resolve the noise until the next morning. If that doesn't resolve it, then it's something more endemic in the actual buildup of the brake pad compound. But I would you know, contact Toyota. It is a known issue in all likelihood, and they probably have either come out with a modified brake pad or a brake rotor or something in the braking system to resolve it.
All right. There you go, David. Thank you. Tim in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I have a 2013 Ford F-150 XLT. I was having problems with when I turned the heat control on inside the truck where it wasn't going on high. And somebody told me to replace wire harness underneath the dash by the glove compartment, which I did that. Well, since then, when I turn on the air conditioner, of course, the radiator fan goes on and off. Sometimes stays on longer than what I think it should. But then also when I turn on my heat inside the truck, the radiator fan motor turns on and stays on and just keeps on running. What can I do to take care of that?
Well, that AC fan should be on when the air conditioner is on. It would not necessarily be on when the heat is on unless you're on defrost. Now, typically, most vehicles are going to have a couple of different defrost settings. There'll be one of them that's just straight up front windshield defrost and another one that might be defrost and blowing out at the floor. Anytime that's set on defrost, the air conditioner's on. Whether your air conditioner switch is on, whether you've turned it on or off or not, the air conditioner comes on with the defrost function. And so if it's in that defrost function, that AC condenser fan should be on. And ultimately, it does tend to run a little bit longer than a lot of people think it should. So I'm not entirely sure you've got a malfunction here. If you turn the heat on and you put it on floor and face, not on defrost at all, that AC fan should not be on. If it is, it's getting a signal that it shouldn't be getting at that point. And so that probably isn't a wiring problem. That's probably something in a control module that is a malfunction. And if that's the case, I'd be surprised if Ford didn't have some kind of a reflash or something for that. But what you're describing may not be a malfunction. If during having heat on, you have it on any kind of frost setting, that's normal.
All right. There you go, Tim. Thank you. Mitchell emailed to say he has a pickup with quite a few miles on it and recently told that there's a seam in the radiator that is starting to go. There doesn't appear to be much leakage at this point, and he's wondering if there's something that could be that could lead to a catastrophic failure, or is it just something to keep your eye on?
Well, I hesitate to recommend keeping your eye on it. Most of the time when a shop sees something like that, they're not seeing a liquid drip. When antifreeze leaks out and then it dries, it leaves these flaky deposits. It depending on the kind of antifreeze, it could either be pink or it could be greenish blue, but they see these flaky deposits. You know, that's a sign that it has leaked at some point in the past and is dried up there, but these things don't heal. And I don't know about your luck, but my luck is that if something like that's going to fail, it's going to be on a day when I'm dressed up and I'm getting in the vehicle and ready to go to a wedding or something. So that's not the kind of thing that you want to put off, unfortunately. That, you know, once upon a time, those radiator tanks, where they're seamed and connected to the radiator fins and core, were brass and metals that could be fixed. In most cases, I don't know what your model is pickup is, but in most cases anymore, those tanks are made out of plastic and they're not really repairable. In most cases, you're going to have to replace it, but I would do that sooner than later. That's not a system that should have any leak in it at all, and even though it doesn't sound like it's a catastrophic leak at this point, I wouldn't wait till it is. There's just too much at risk in terms of potentially overheating the engine and causing some far more expensive repairs and just the inconvenience. It's not going to happen on a day you have time. It just never does.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that question. Jim in Door County, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Hey, I've got a 2018 4Runner that I like to store this winter. And back in the day, I would just pull a battery and put it in the basement and come back next spring and hook it up. And somebody said, no. And then I also talked to, I think, somebody at Toyota, and they said you do not want to pull that battery because you'll have a hard time getting it to even idle next spring if you do that. So I'm going to put it on a trickle charger, and I just want to make sure that's what I should be doing. I did call the trickle charger manufacturer because I've heard stories of those things burning down garages, and they said they checked my trickle charger and said you should be good to go. So is it true I need the trickle charge and I cannot pull the battery?
You may very well have problems if you pull the battery. You know, there are many things on modern vehicles that are what are called adaptive, and it basically means that the vehicle learns these things as time goes on. And one of the things that's adaptive is the idle for that particular engine. And, you know, so it's not uncommon that, you know, we'll find a situation where vehicle battery has gone dead when it's in storage, and when they get a new battery or get that battery charged up, they'll start the engine and it doesn't want to idle. It doesn't mean that's not a repairable condition. I mean, typically you just have to sit in the car and keep your foot on the gas and keep it running for about 10 minutes for it to relearn that idle. But, you know, that can be a pain, you know, and there are other things that it will have lost the memory for. As you drive a vehicle, most your 4Runner has got an adaptive throttle. So if you're someone who accelerates and you stomp that thing to the floor every time, that computer says, wow, this person wants it all. So it's going to change your first quarter inch of accelerator pedal movement to give more throttle opening than someone who accelerates very lightly or always backs off because it's more than expected. And many systems on the vehicle are that way, and they're adaptive. And when the battery's out of it that long, it's going to forget all of that and going to have to relearn it. And so with the way the transmission shifts, the way it accelerates, you know, that idle condition is something that can occur when a battery is pulled from the vehicle or if the battery discharges for a long period of time. So if it's possible to keep it in it and use a battery tender, and you've got a good battery tender that, you know, it's when those things first started coming out, some of them were shaky circuitry and did, you know, did cause some problems. But, you know, the modern ones, that's a technology that's been around for a long time. It's been used in the marine industry for a long time. You know, so if you've got a good one that's good to go, that's going to be the preferred way to do it, to handle your battery.
Thank you, Jim. Rich in Bayfield. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, we got a 2019 RAV4 hybrid. Everything's great on the FM radio is great, but when we turn on the AM radio, even locally by the stations around here, as soon as that battery kicks in, the AM is destroyed. It's all static. Is that normal?
It doesn't sound normal, and I'm trying to remember bulletins. This is something that's a really familiar sounding issue, and I think you may find with your rear defrost on that you might make noise over your radio as well. And I do think that there is a resolution for that. I do not recall what it is right off the bat, but I would encourage you to contact a Toyota dealer with those symptoms and run them by them. I can't. It's a familiar symptom. I know that there is a fix for it. I don't believe that it's in the radio itself at all. It's an interference that is being picked up by the radio. And I, for the life of me right now, I can't recall what it is. But, yeah, contact a Toyota dealer, let them know what you're experiencing, and have them take a look at service bulletins. I think they're going to find your answer.
All right. There we go. And on to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Hello, again. Hi. I've got a 2006 Toyota Matrix. And I love my go-kart. The thing is awesome. And I got it for free from my mother-in-law. But I noticed in the front end on each of the tires, it's making a noise when you go over bumps and stuff. I was wondering what you think that is and how much you think it would cost to fix my go-kart.
So what kind of noise do you hear on bumps?
Like a big clunking sound on each side. I'm thinking tie rod or something, but...
Well, it is possible. One of the most common cause for that kind of noise is what are called stabilizer links. There's a bar that sets up a certain tension on your suspension on each side, and it's connected by a little set of links, a little couple ball and socket knuckles with rubber bushings. And sometimes the bushings are available separate. Sometimes you have to buy the link. But the majority of time, the noise you're describing is going to be caused by those stabilizer links or stabilizer bushings.
There you go. Get those repaired or replaced, and there you go, Nick. Thank you. Tom in Hudson, your turn. Hi, Tom. We're not hearing Tom. He had a 2017 Civic with brake fluid issues. And I don't know any more than that, unfortunately. So,
well, I have seen Honda Civic have problems with their brake lines rusting out and leaking, but I have no idea if that was the nature of his question or call.
Well, we've got some other calls here. I'm sorry, Tom, we can't help you there. Jim emailed that he was told by his mechanic he needed to replace tires since the rear ones were cupping. He has a 2010 Prius and keeps the tires slightly higher pressure than recommended, about 38 PSI as opposed to 35 PSI in the back. Might that cause the cupping, or could it be that he hasn't rotated them often enough? Usually every 10,000 miles, tires only have 40,000 miles and are the same he's used in the past, and he's been able to get to 80,000 miles on them.
Sure, sure. The tire rotation is likely to be the issue here. The tire pressure, actually, most manufacturers recommend going into colder weather. They'll have a chart that will tell a technician or a mechanic to increase the tire pressure by this much, depending on what the anticipated outside ambient temperature is going to be over the next 6 months. So obviously in Wisconsin in the winter, when the temperature drops, there'll be an increase of about 3 pounds, and that's what you're doing. 35 pounds is the recommended pressure for that. 38 would be completely appropriate this time of year. It won't cause cup tires, but tire rotations recommended by Toyota every 5,000 miles. You might be able to get away with 7,500 miles, but the drive tires in the front of that car wouldn't do this from being on the front, but the ones on the back, because they're not driven and they're just following, do tend to start to cup when you start to get in that range of 7,500 to 10,000 mile intervals. So I would have to say, in my experience, it's a tire rotation interval that needs to be increased and done more frequently to prevent that cupping.
Dan in Albion, Iowa, emailed. He has a 2007 Ford Freestyle with a CVT transmission. How does he know when that transmission is about to fail?
Well, CVT transmissions generally have fewer issues and fewer moving parts and less complicated systems inside than a conventional automatic transmission. But the symptoms that they're going to have would be similar to any transmission if it were going to fail, which would be, slipping of the transmission, the engine kind of revving between shifts or hard shifts or, a harsh upshift or downshift would be the common things. The fluid typically was probably sealed, so it's not something you're likely to be able to check yourself, but it can be checked if you start having problems to see if the fluid itself has got metal in it, which might be indicating some kind of a failure inside.
Mary emailed, her new vehicle has a terrible noise when she backs up. The dealer says it's a pedestrian warning. Is this common to be so screechy? Her hybrid engine also makes loud noises off and on when it idles. And is that common for these vehicles? But I don't know the name of the vehicle.
Well, hybrid vehicles have a lot of different noises that conventional vehicles never had that we weren't used to before we had hybrids. And it actually is a law that manufacturers have to have a sound produced from hybrid for the benefit of people who are blind that might be in an intersection and not realize that there's a car right there next to them. So it is actually a speaker that produces the sound, and they often have a different sound for when in reverse or when they're just in gear going forward. I remember when Toyota changed the sound a couple of years ago, we called the new sound the Choir of Angels because it just what it sounded like. So chances are these are normal sounds. Again, I guess if you've taken it to your technician and they checked it out and said it's normal, I would certainly vouch for that, and that there are many, many noises that you may hear from hybrid vehicles that you're not going to hear in a conventional vehicle.
And here we are out of time, Jim. Boy, what a pleasure to have you back. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's been fun. You bet, Larry. Good to be here again.
Jim Ward, a retired last year as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, and it was great to have him back. He knows a whole lot, doesn't he? It was fun to visit with him. Susan Carpenter joins us on Garden Talk tomorrow from the UW Arboretum. Talk about native gardening and getting your native plants ready for the colder weather. And don't forget, I will be at the Wisconsin Science Festival on Saturday from 1:45 to 2:45, talking about fungi, the good, the bad, and the ugly. You can go to wisconsinsciencefest.org to register for that free event. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.